There is in everyone the urge towards happiness in some form or other. The man of the world or the religious man equally seeks happiness. And this happiness is surely a state of calm inside one, an undisturbed state. That does not mean inactive, but an undisturbed state. And in Buddhist teaching particularly, we find the greatest emphasis laid upon calm and insight. The Buddha says frequently that the supreme happiness is nirvana. So we have this business of happiness associated with the state of calm. To what extent have we in our lifetime realized calm? This is a very important question, isn't it? And it is particularly significant in our day and age, which is characterized by greater and greater noise and turmoil, disturbance of every sort. This inward calm in the midst of it all. And intellectually we may accept, yes, of course, we need calm, therefore we will find ways and means of producing calm. But instead of approaching it that way, suppose we approach it another way. What lies at the root of calm? Have we ever really inquired into this? People will say, oh, to have no worries. If everything is all right, then we are in a state of peace and happiness. But what do they mean by saying, if everything is all right? Surely they mean that their world, their milieu, is one which is exactly according to their desire of the moment. But my neighbor's desire is different. And therefore, what he wants and what he seeks to bring about is going to conflict with what I want and I am going to seek to bring about. Therefore, that is a calm, if one attains it, that is a calm whose base rests on shifting sands. There's nothing stable there. It is something dependent upon conditions. And that which is dependent, unquestionably, is the perishable. Doesn't live. How does one realize inward calm? A calm which, despite any circumstance which is extremely troublesome and difficult in the world, an inward calm which will stay undisturbed. What is the root of this calm? Don't you think that it is what the great teachers of all the religions simply called morality? What is it that is most disturbing to oneself? The continuous struggle, right and wrong. Was this well done? Was this ill done? Was this rightly felt and thought, or was it ill felt and thought? And so forth. And is not that intimately bound up with the simple moralities which we find in the great religions, whether we call them advices and precepts, as we do in Hindu and Buddhist teachings, or whether we call them commandments, as we do in Judeo-Christian teaching, and in Islamic and Zarathustrian teaching, we call them commands, commands of the Lord. Whatever we call them, is it not just those simple moralities which really lie at the root of the condition of inner calmness? This is very important. We have considered again and again how significant it is that the great teachers never presented a metaphysical system as such. They didn't bother about such things. There is, of course, the implied philosophy behind their teaching of calm and control and peace and all the rest of it, of ordinary behavior in everyday life. There is the implied philosophy. But they themselves never spent any time, practically, upon producing a philosophy. They just said, good thoughts, good words, good deeds, as Zarathustra did. Or there were the usual commandments, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and strength and so forth, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, and the usual things. And especially in our day and age, we are inclined to get a bit impatient with these and say, oh, what's all this goody-goody Victorianism coming out? Well, was there anything wrong with Victorianism? Or is there something inadequate or purblind in us? You can look at it both ways, couldn't you? What was wrong with Victorian morality was perhaps its smugness, its hypocrisy, its those aspects of it. But the morality as such is absolutely right. It is true. Take the very first thing which all the religions talk about. Do not kill. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not shed blood. Put it in the Hindu-Buddhist way, particularly the Hindu way, which is an extraordinarily inclusive way. Harmlessness, that's the key word. It includes everything. To kill is to harm. And you can harm without killing, but by hurting, doing wrong, offending in a thousand different ways. And you can apply that to all that exists in the world. You can harm anything and everything. Not only by the hurtful, painful action, but by the thought, the feeling. See, the Buddha said, he who lives without harming himself, without harming others, lives with a self, become Brahman, the Absolute, become God, if you like to use a theistic term. Now this business of harming or not harming really is the overriding factor in morality, in all morality. Consider stealing. Stealing is a harming, isn't it? Consider any misbehavior in human relationships, whether they be sexual or between employer and employee, teacher and pupil, parent and child, and so forth and so forth. All that is a question of harming or not harming. Take the question of speech. And you know what importance the Buddha laid upon speech, right speech. And truthfulness in speech is something which has been emphasized very, very strongly by all the religions, by all groups or societies which have been concerned with the good life. Truth speaking is of the utmost importance. And this has been the case way back into primitive times. Before there was anything like Zarathustrianism in Iran, truth speaking was absolutely enjoined upon all the inhabitants of Iran, the Iranians. Their great tests were, does this fellow speak the truth? Does he ride a horse well? And one or two other important minor things like that. But truth speaking above all. This is interesting, isn't it? So if one doesn't speak the truth, then one is harming. But if one is speaking the truth, then one is not harming. If one speaks maliciously, slanderously, rudely, harshly, all these things are harmful ways of speech. If one speaks out of place, out of time, it can do harm to oneself as well as to others, couldn't it? This happens again and again in our lives. And all the other precepts which differ slightly according to the particular religion, the particular society in which those things sprang up. The Jews had certain sets of rules, the Buddhists had others, the Hindus had others, and so forth and so forth. But all these moralities seem to me to have harmlessness, non-hurting, either of the self or of the not-self, of other people, animals, trees, things, objects, everything. It seems to me that harmlessness lies at the root of it. But is not harmlessness only another word for love? Can he who does not love be harmless? Is he who is harmless ever not loving? not friendly. This thing we call friendliness, loving kindness, metta in the Buddhistic term, maitri, the Sanskrit Hindu term. Friendship in the real sense, friendship. Is not all this the non-harming state? See, we never seem to appreciate the importance of harmlessness. We sort of take it for granted, yes, we should be a kind man. Let's sit there or here. And we do not go sufficiently deeply, therefore, into the importance of being harmless. Let's look at it this way. We all take for granted that, of course, man has a great deal of aggressiveness in him. He's inherited it. And he must have that kind of training by which he can harness this power of aggressiveness and use it for constructive purposes. It is an inadequate way of looking at it. What sort of construction will emerge out of that which is destructive in itself? If you take that which is destructive in itself and try to plan out ways of expressing it constructively, you will not be resilient. You will not give way before the infinite resilience, which is the omnipotence of God, infinite resilience. You won't give way before it. You will find ways, you will try to find ways and means to turn it round to your purposes. And when we do that, we are always presuming that our purposes are good and proper and correct. There is always that assumption, I am right. But if one sees the truth about harmfulness in ourselves, which is tied up with aggressiveness and so many other things too besides aggressiveness, self-centeredness, fearfulness in ourselves is also tied up with harmfulness. Because we are fearful, we carry out this, that and the other harmful process, harmful to somebody, in order to protect ourselves. If we see the harmfulness in us and let it become transformed into the harmless condition, because we have come up directly face to face with the harmfulness in ourselves, then harmlessness will flower. See, one of the great troubles is this. Our whole upbringing and education is such that we suffer from the illusion that we know. We may qualify it by saying that we know at least a little bit of what is the positive good. Now this is true only within the limited worldly context, the context of conflicting duality. In the context of conflicting duality, there is always a better and a worse, a more and a less, and so on and so on. But the religious context is concerned with the transcendent, with becoming free of this conflicting duality awareness of our existence. See, this is the important point as far as the religious context is concerned. It's the context of the transcendent. And where transcendence is concerned, there is no such thing as knowing something about the positive good, knowing a little more about it or a little less about it. So whilst it is true in the ordinary worldly context, the context of duality, the context of conflict, of confusion, of disharmony, why is the conflict and the disharmony there? Because there is confusion, there is ignorance. Therefore, there is the possibility of disorder and disorder. But in the truly religious context, which is the proper human context, the human being is fundamentally and essentially a religious being, and only secondarily and very unimportantly a political, social, economic animal. In this transcendent context, which is his right and proper context of full, true humanity, there is no such thing as having some idea of the positive good. Then you have the real good. And the interesting point is, and the point of profound importance and significance, is that you have the positive good, not because you, the separate individual, have it, but the totality which is and knows the positive good functions unhindered through you. This is the important point. This imposition of self is out of the situation altogether. As long as there is the slightest imposition of self upon the situation, upon the milieu, and if you like to extend the milieu upon the totality, there is necessarily the conflict of what we commonly call evil and good. All this conflict of evil and good, good and evil, is the self obstructing, the little self obstructing the totality. Unto Caesar, a penny. Nowadays it's a little more than a penny. But unto Caesar, the penny, or the pennies, as the case may be. But unto God, what is God's? Jesus said. And what is God's? The totality, the whole self, completely and utterly, unreservedly, unquestioningly, unconditionally, it is God. There is no me or mine in the presence of the absolute. And then one is in the harmless state. Isn't that so? But what a happy state that is. Now just try and sort of feel it. But if this selfness just vanished away, one grasps at nothing whatsoever, just lets go, completely give way before the infinite resilience. And then the totality maintains and preserves you as the whole of you, as the pure, fulfilled, triumphant individual. This is the marvel and the mystery of it all. And yet, as far as I myself am concerned, there is no self. Freedom, happiness. There is the real freedom and the real happiness, surely. But you see, its root in my everyday life is just ordinary morality. Being a good chap, in the real sense of the term. And the difficulty is to know the real sense of the term good chap. That's the difficulty. See, we can rattle off, don't kill, don't harm, don't steal, don't this, don't the other, or we can say, speak the truth, be kind, be gentle, be helpful, be sensible. We can say all this. And having said that, what? So many particles of air have vibrated to convey that sound to the other person. The other person has listened, and he says enthusiastically, oh yes, of course, and carries on just as before. This is the sad part of the story.
Also keep all the precepts or commandments, and still there is nothing there, can't there? I mean, there's something more even than just keeping carrying out the precepts or keeping the commandments. There is still this giving up oneself to the resilience that can be done without that, and it's still not harmless.
You see, the keeping of the precepts or the obeying of the commandments has to go right beyond the stage where I keep the precepts and I obey the commands. As long as I do that, there is a self-interest inevitably associated with that keeping of the precepts. See, it is inevitable. There is a selfness there. I am keeping the precepts. But there comes the point when the precepts are just naturally kept. There is no I keeping the precepts. The precepts are being kept through this person. They have become second nature. See, it's a little bit like this, only a little bit, but yet a little bit like this. The normal healthy bodily processes go on just naturally. I'm not conscious of them. I don't need to be conscious of them, to control them, to guide them. The streaming of the blood, the beating of the heart, the working of the lungs, etc., etc. It just goes on. The life process does the business in the same way. The divine process, if you like, just does the business. You see? How and when does the divine process just do the business? When the self-consciousness has freed itself of its illusion of me, mine, attaining, achieving, obtaining what is desirable. Then the selfness is out. Surely in life we see that the desirable is actually present millions of times, in millions of places, and in millions of ways, is it not? Just by itself, naturally. It is only when it gets obstructed that the trouble begins. For instance, supposing there is a storm. All right? The winds blow hard, all the trees, the branches sway this way and that way, and the leaves fall, the flowers get battered with the rain and whatnot. Perhaps the trees fall down. But they have just responded to the forces at play. And that's that. That's the story. In the telling of the story is ended. But with us, the story is never ended. We want the thing to be different. We want the wind to be different, for the storm to be at after midnight when we have come back from the party, and not now, and so forth. It's curious. We cannot sort of harmonize with the flow of life. We are always wishing something else. If I'm here, I'm wishing I was in India. If I'm in India, I'm wishing I was in America. And so forth. If it is Sunday, I'm wishing it was Wednesday. And vice versa. You see what I mean by this obstructing the flow of life? We obstruct it all the time. And so calm is not there, nor happiness. But let there be this real basis of morality, and the Buddha particularly, who discourse after discourse, out come the same old things. Hearken, bhikkhus, here are the five strands of pleasure. Sight, hearing, touch, taste, etc. You see, the pleasures of the senses, beware. See, they are the perpetuators of guilt. And if you take delight in all the sense experiences and the mental experiences, that is to say all the cultural pursuits and whatnot and whatnot, if you take delight in them, grasp them and hanker after them, you are everlastingly going to have the cycle of birth and death. It begins, it ends, it begins, it ends, day after day in our lifetime. And when it has ended and when it is gone, or when we can't get the seat which we wanted in order to see Swan Lake or whatever it is, we are miserable about it. You don't hanker after it. I don't even go to them nowadays. That's the whole point. Now, when you came in, you remember, you came in first today. You remember how those birds were singing? There was the beauty and the joy of it. The sense of hearing was at play. The wonderful, happy thing took place. Then other members came in. It is another wonderful, happy thing. And so the whole thing just goes on. But don't grasp it. Let life just flow along. And be awake to it. And that is the happiness. When I am in Piccadilly Circus, with all that traffic and noise and so on, let me be awake to it. And when I am here, let me not hanker for the noise and traffic of Piccadilly Circus. Or when I am there, let me not hanker for the quiet and peace of this room. No. This is how it is, right? Pay attention to it. Be in the world, completely in, and totally, entirely not of the world. This is the great thing. But this means morality. This means not harming, not grasping. Being utterly truthful to the immediate fact. Being free of slavery to the senses, sense pleasures, the hankering after sense pleasures and so on. The Buddha never really did teach that you should avoid, positively avoid all sense pleasures like poison, you see, and this and that. I'm sure he never really taught that. There are sort of indications in the Pali canon which may quite legitimately make one think that way. Some of the things he's supposed to have said about women, for instance, you see. For one thing, he said, he's supposed to have said, do not ever fall into the hell of marriage. You see? And if you do get caught in marriage, see that you are perfectly faithful, you see, and no inchastity, no whatever it is, you see. And so, those are attributed to him. He may have said it, I don't know. But the fact is the Buddha was wise. And wise people do not make extremist statements in the context of duality. They make absolute affirmations regarding the transcendent, but never extremist statements in the context of duality. This is a very important point and a very great difference. For instance, when we talk of, when we are trying to understand and to enter into the nature of the transcendent, we make an absolute affirmation of being totally free of all confusion, of all illusion. You know, your intelligent man of the world would say, but that's not humanly possible. This is just absurd. In the context of duality, it is absurd. But in the context of the transcendent, that is the simple fact. It's quite another matter. So, let's look at this again. Happiness. Inward calm. Harmlessness. Friendliness, love, and all that they imply. They are all bound up together. Let us look at some of the things two great teachers said. First, let us look at these sayings by the Buddha, which come in the third volume of the Long Discourses, known as the Sigalovada homily, the Sigala homily. Sigala is a young Brahmin who comes out early in the morning, jumps into the river or the village pond, as the case may be, has his bath, and with his hair all wet, he starts his ceremonial performance as a proper Brahmin. One of the items is the worship of the six quarters, as they are called. North, south, east, west, the zenith and the nadir, you see. And the Buddha happens to be close by. So he asks him, what are you doing? And he says, I am carrying out such and such a ceremonial because I'm a Brahmin. See? And then, of course, you know the way the Buddha had of bringing things round to the inner reality of the whole thing and not just the outward form of it. And the young Brahmin listens enthralled. But he speaks to him in a very simple way, as like a preacher in the pulpit, you know, just delivering a nice sermon. But consider some of the things he says. He's talking about friends and friendship. He talks about the one who pretends to be a friend, but who really is not a friend. And he says things like this about such comrades and friends. He says, dicing and women drink the dance and songs, sleeping by day, prowling around at night, friendship with wicked men, hardness of heart, these causes bring a man to ruin. It is, of course, simple common sense. But he also says, he who proves a comrade in your hour of need, him may you rightly call a friend indeed. We have this identical English proverb, haven't we? We have the statement, a friend in need is a friend indeed. And there are the words of the Buddha himself on that matter. Then we come to a very interesting passage in this discourse. He says, he addresses Sigala, who is a young householder, after all. He says, oh young householder, four are the friends who should be reckoned as sound at heart. The helper, the friend who is the same in happiness and adversity, the friend of good counsel, the friend who sympathizes. Not all that sounds very simple. But let's go on. On four grounds, the friend who is a helper, that is the first type, is to be reckoned as sound at heart. He guards you when you are off your guard. Now, the commentaries written upon these discourses, they sort of give examples and explanations and so forth. And one of the commentaries upon the Digha Nikaya explains what is meant by off your guard. And your friend guarding you when you are off your guard. If your friend sees you fallen down anywhere in the village after drinking spirits, he sits down by you till you wake, lest your cloak should be stolen. But you know, this is especially interesting as giving some picture of the conditions of the times and the sort of thing that happened. Nowadays something else would happen. Second, he guards your property when you are off your guard. Third, he is a refuge to you when you are afraid. Now, there are hundreds of situations in our lives when we are afraid, aren't we, of this, that, and the other. And he is a refuge to you when you are afraid. And then, when you have tasks to perform, he provides a double supply. And the commentary says, if you go to him burdened with a commission involving outlay, he presses you to accept double what you will require to spend. So you see, Nikki, when you go to a man and tell him that to start this business you need £50,000, if he's a good friend of yours, he'll press you to accept £100,000. This is how the commentary puts it. On four grounds, the friend who is the same in happiness and adversity is to be reckoned as sound of heart. He tells you his secrets. He keeps secret your secrets. In your troubles, he does not forsake you. He lays down even his life for your sake. It's interesting that this should suddenly come in this context, just like that. On four grounds, the friend who declares what you need to do is sound of heart. He restrains you from doing wrong. He enjoins you to do right. He informs you of what you had not heard before. He reveals to you the way to heaven. These are the acts of friendship as portrayed in those times. And lastly, on four grounds, the friend who sympathizes is to be reckoned as sound at heart. He does not rejoice over your misfortunes. He rejoices over your prosperity. Now this may sound quite simple and Sunday schoolish and so forth to us, but consider carefully. The friend who sympathizes is the one who does not rejoice over your misfortune. I am the friend of XY, we'll say. Now, when I hear that he's had a little misfortune here or there, I am supposed, according to this, not to rejoice. Now, what do I actually do? I might feel sorry for him. I'm sure to feel sorry for him if I'm a friend at all. But whilst I'm feeling sorry for him, am I or am I not also feeling, but you know, he was such an idiot, serve him right. Do I feel that or not? Or do I perhaps also feel, but yet he's had a bad time, but you know, he's a bit of a lad, it'll do him good to have that trouble. I am smugly, of course, the good fellow. But quite seriously, I mean, right from childhood onwards, don't we sort of have all this mixture of feelings in relation to him whom we call a friend? See, if we can really see this in our own nature, really see it completely, face it directly, totally, without resisting it, without trying to alter it, keeping quiet. But this keeping quiet is the supreme resistance, if you like. It is that non-violent resistance, non-harmful resistance, which transforms the thing. Transformation doesn't take place without energy. There must be some energy to effect the transformation. See? And it is precisely this steady looking, this profound mindfulness, this complete mindfulness. Mindfulness mustn't be a superficial thing. See, our mindfulness, after all, is a very superficial thing. You will notice that our mindfulness functions very much under the control of our evaluations, our criteria, our approvals and disapprovals. And as soon as some little approval or disapproval has emerged from the psyche, we let it go out of our minds. This is what we mustn't do. We must just continuously look at it. Look at it continuously, intensely. Because then it will call up all our judgments, our reactions. We will see that also. You get what I mean? So you not only see the external thing as such, but at the same time you see your own reactions to it. And it is your seeing your own reactions which is the source of self-knowledge. And when you continue to look at your own reactions steadily, quietly, that is to say, without taking any steps with regard to your own reactions, then that psychical energy, which is your reaction, dissolves away. And there is peace, there is quiet. There is the state of calm, the inner calm. You can bring about inner calm temporarily by carrying out all kinds of techniques. Hindu and Buddhist yoga, for instance, they all have their techniques. The Christian mystical methods all have their techniques, you see. You are asked to direct your attention to this, that, or the other, or to bring up the contrary thought if you have an evil thought. But to bring up the contrary thought is to have conflict. And if you follow the Hindu-Buddhist yoga methods, for example, certain postures, the repetition of certain words, or breathing methods and all that, all the rest of it, what are you doing? That is just a dope. That is not the natural, healthy state. It's perfectly true that if you are in distress, you do need a certain amount of dope in order to alleviate the pain which has become unbearable. Perfectly true. For instance, if a person has an absolutely dreadful toothache, either you pull the tooth out or give him a dose of morphia or some such thing, or whatever it is. I mention morphia because in my Cambridge days, my physics coach one day suffered most agonizing pain from a toothache, and his doctor, seeing the condition he was in, said, "Look, I'll give you a dose of morphia to send you off for 24 hours. It's no good giving a small dose. We'll give you a real heavy dose, send you off to sleep for 24 hours, and that will probably help you." He took it, and he woke up free of the toothache. Now, of course, under such circumstances, one does that. But that is not the natural, healthy thing. See, we are concerned with the natural, healthy thing. And when we look at whatever reaction has come up in our own mind, look at it without doing anything about it, whether the reaction be of a what we commonly call a good nature or what we commonly call an evil nature. If we look at it completely, both the duals disappear. This is something which is not explicit, not clearly shown in the religious teachings of the world. This transcendence of duality is not by tackling one aspect of the dual and putting it into conflict with the opposite aspect. That is not the way. This is the way transcendence takes place in the psyche.
Look at whatever is there, good or bad. Don't resist it, don't encourage it. Don't encourage it because you feel this is good. Don't resist it because you feel it is evil. Completely look at it. And the partial good, the good in duality, will dissolve away. The partial evil, the evil within the sphere of duality, will dissolve away, and the transcendent total good alone will be there. This is the real key to the process which takes place. And this is very important, and this is terribly difficult, because we can't sustain the looking. This is what needs the gird your loins and at it at attitude, you see. The tremendous energy which you have to have. And you don't direct it one way or the other, you just hold it in reserve. It is a state of continence. You're self-contained, completely self-contained, so completely self-contained that either dual in the world of conflict is of no avail against you or for you. And then the transcendent reality is there. And you know, you see the significance, the meaning, the beauty, the marvel of being a human being. In those conditions and moments, you know humanity in the true sense. You're in the harmless state. You have not opposed, you have not promoted the one because it is the better, because that means always promoting this against that. Obviously, you're taking sides. You've got a wholeness. And in that wholeness, there is purity, there is peace, there is no evil. That's the holiness. So now, consider a thing like this. He does not rejoice over your misfortunes. He rejoices over your prosperity. Let us come back to our ordinary, everyday life. If I am a friend, I rejoice over the other person's prosperity. Yes, of course, I congratulate him and please, I pat him on the back and say, well done, jolly good. But didn't I feel just a little touch of envy? Wasn't I a little bit disappointed that, oh, I missed seeing that myself, otherwise I could have done it. Eh? Or somebody else got the chair of philosophy in the university. And I said, oh, well, let it go. It's not very important. It's not a very fine university. Grapes get sour very easily. Am I really rejoicing over his prosperity? Is it ever possible for me totally to rejoice in another person's good and well-being, so long as I, a separate self, am rejoicing? If I'm in the singles final and the other chap wins, and of course I rush off to the net, you see, and shake him by the hand and all the rest of it and lift up my racket. But what's happening inside my mind and heart? Just exactly what is happening, without any illusion about it. Is it utterly pure? You see, these simple goody-goody things, and they, you know, in the ordinary way, as the words are, as the words stand, they sound just the usual goody-goody Sunday schoolish stuff. But you know, this is truth, isn't it? This is reality. If I look into it carefully, I see the whole meaning, significance, beauty, the tremendousness of life and the life process of fulfillment and all the rest of it. And then if you look at it the other way, do not most of us human beings, certainly in the sort of what we call the advanced civilized countries, we who live a decent life from day to day, do we not suffer from a little bit of unwarranted conceit? We have no grounds for our conceit that we are such good folk. Where is our real goodness? And if I was really good, would I know it with my mind? This is the point, isn't it? The eyes being placed in my face as they are placed, I can only see outwards. I can't see my own face. Supposing my face was a very attractive, handsome face, my eyes would never know it. They would never see it. They would just be looking at everybody else's face. That's it. Well, instead of the eyes, let us put the word mind. If I were really good, my mind wouldn't see it. I wouldn't know.